Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go. We just finished Kip Gross out there in Newport Beach, where he's probably playing Gilligan's Island with the boat and everything, the Gross Misconduct Podcast. Now we go right into Cleveland, Ohio. The American Sports History Podcast, hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend, Peter Ray. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing this in Los Angeles, 347-205-9631. If you happen to miss it, I realize 30 minutes goes by quick. blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports. Podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me, let me lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, the threes, Peter. How are you? How can people get a hold of you? And your wife must be sitting next to this show of yours because this is her favorite guest. Take it away as I man the boards, my friend.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. It's my name, Peter J. Rea. You're absolutely right. Tonight's guest played Major League Baseball from 1971 to 1981 with the Chicago Cubs, Oakland A's, L.A. Dodgers, and San Francisco Giants. He's tied for 79th all-time career stolen bases with Dave Collins. Won two World Series in 1973 and 74 with the Oakland A's, 395 career stolen bases, two-time American League stolen base leader in 1974-1976, more than 1,000 MLB hits, the first Oakland A's DH, won a National League title in 78 with the Dodgers, three times led the American League in total chances per game, twice in putouts, once an assist from the outfield on a double play. And you're right, my dear wife Alice's favorite podcast guest because he's a good man with a good heart and a good sense of humor. Welcome to the show for the, 29th time, Mr. Bill North.
Hey, Alice, how are you? Hey, Peter, how are you?
I'm fine. Also, I forgot to mention the starting center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's, from the early 1970s.
Yeah, they kept running me out there for some reason.
So, Bill, tell us all about the Buffalo Soldiers Museum and your community service award.
Well, I'll tell you, Peter, to make a short story long, my mom, when I was growing up, was a compatriot and a supporter of the Buffalo Soldiers. Buffalo Soldiers were a group of men, most of them from Africa and the West Indies, and that came to America to fight the wars that America was in, the French, the Revolutionary War, and they lived on. Bob Marley has a wonderful song about it, and I kind of got that through my heritage, because my mom put them in me, and to be honored by them is certainly makes my mom happy, I know, and it makes me happy to make my mom happy. God rest her soul. And so that's it. And what a wonderful gift.
Now, on September 6th, you had a night with Bill North at Ricky's in San Leandro. $100 a plate. How did it go? Tell us all about that.
Pretty good. We didn't raise all the money we wanted to raise, but you never do. But yeah, we had a good time. It was a wonderful night. I was, as Mark had spoken about Andy Dolich, well, and the book he and Dave Newhouse wrote, and Dave Newhouse was my other, he was a host with me. And I know Andy for a long time, but it's the kind of thing that it's a small world. And we're going to try and get him on next week, Andy Dolich and maybe Dave Newhouse. But it's a good, it was a good evening. I got a lot of exposure for my, our foundation. It's called the North Legacy Project. And we're in partnership with the Urban League in Seattle. And if you look it up online, there's a place to donate. Our website, because we're making some changes, is in construction. But I would like for people to know about that, because our whole thing is about helping kids. And that was a good commercial. Thanks, Ben.
So you saw Dave Newhouse and Andy Dolich.
Well, I saw Dave. I've known Dave for 50 years. He used to be the beat writer for the Oakland A's, the Oakland Tribune, and he traveled with us and everything, and we became friends. He's a really, really good writer. He's written. He's an award-winning author. He's written over, this is his 20th book, I think, Goodbye Oakland. But he is one of the best journalists. He's in his 80s now, but he's a friend of mine. And I always enjoy him because he's so interesting. And Andy worked for the Oakland A's. He worked for Charlie Finley back in the day. Yeah.
Is Dave Newhouse writing your biography?
No, he's not writing my biography, dear.
Okay. Did that topic come up?
No. I know, nope. You told me to ask him about it, but no, it didn't.
Okay, maybe next time.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we could write a short biography. It's getting late for both of us.
Oh. Yeah, the Oakland A's Hall of Fame ballot, I think the voting ended. We'll find out if you made it on the write-in ballot by probably the end of the month. They're going to announce at the end of the month. I watched Game 6 of the 1973 World Series. It was in Oakland, and you guys were down 3-1 going in. You won the game 3-1, Catfish Hunter against Tom Seaver, tied up the series 3-3. Reggie had two RBIs. Daryl Knowles struck out Reggie's Rusty Staub on three pitches with two runners on late in the game.
There you go.
That was cool. Raleigh Fingers got the save. There was a tremendous catch by Dick Green in foul ground. He ran a long way. Vic Davalio was in center. Reggie was in right. Actually, the video is not too good. It's radio, and the radio sound isn't good. And I guess it was very bright sun, and there's not much video left of that game. So if you watch and listen, it's radio guys Jim Simpson and Ralph Kiner. Staub was struggling with throwing the ball in from right field. Dick Williams put Darren Johnson at first. Dean Tennis was catching. He had Ray Fossey on the bench trying to get more offense.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see what else I got here. Late in the game, Kurt Gowdy said that Tug McGraw could have fun in a stalled elevator. Oh, I thought that was good.
I always say, give me a string and put me in a closet. I'll have a good time. And most of the time, I don't. And most of the time, I don't even need the string. Now.
Gene Tennis had 10 walks, and he was the record was Babe Ruth with 11 in the 27 World Series. Jesus Salute kept crossing himself. That's Roman Catholic. I remember as a growing up, my first exposure to the Catholic Church was seeing these Latin players crossing themselves before batting. Mm-hmm. He would cross himself before every pitch, I think. And then he went in as a pinch hitter, and then it was warming his arm in the bullpen to go in and play the outfield. So do you have any thoughts on the Game 6 of the 73 World Series?
I was probably watching it at home. It was in Oakland, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. I was probably watching it at home because, being at the ballpark kind of hurt a little bit.
Right.
But, hey, man, we won.
You pushed to game seven and then won that, yeah.
Yeah, hey, man. Yeah. Couldn't break up that three-peat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a wonderful thing. That was, hey, man, three in a row. And we think we could have won more.
Right.
Yeah.
I also watched baseball seasons. I've been going through that. 1968, the Tigers beat the Cardinals in seven. Guys like Al Kaline, mm-hmm. Mickey Lolich, Lou Brock, Bob Gibson, the year of the mm-hmm. pitcher. And there was a great they had interviewed former players for this. This was made around 2010. And they had, Willie Horton told a story quoting Jim Northrup, his teammate, as saying, with respect, he quoted Northrup talking about Bob Gibson, and he said, "I didn't know God was black." I thought that was a good line.
Well, yeah, kind of sacrilegious, but
yeah. Well, that's true. Oh boy!
But what happened when Bob Gibson was pitching? There's a bunch of them that went to the plate and said, "Oh Lordy!"
Oh boy! That was quite. Now were you in the minors in '68?
No, I hadn't signed. I signed in '69.
Oh, you were still in college.
I was in college hitting over 400. I like that. That was when I could really hit, Peter. I got drafted in '69.
Let's see that season though. Yeah, game one of the World Series. Bob Gibson had 17 strikeouts in game one. Denny McClain won 30 games last time that's happened. Don Drysdale threw six straight shutouts. Ferguson Jenkins lost 5-1 nothing games. Catfish Hunter had
20 wins.
Yeah. Catfish Hunter had a first American League perfect game since 1922. The Yankees batted .214. Carl Yastrzemski won the batting title with .301. Tony Perez said, Tony Perez was interviewed, and he said his wife would go to the bathroom when he was facing Bob Gibson. Oh, because
you talked about one of my favorite players,
yeah.
Carl Yastrzemski. He could play, man. He could really play, and could hit. I saw him when the one year that Seattle had that team, the Seattle Pilots, and Boston came in there. Him and Reggie Smith were in that outfield. My college team, we were at that game, and they were in the outfield doing gymnastic flips and all that kind of stuff. I mean, tremendous athletes. I couldn't do that. Yeah. They were good in space. Yeah.
I'm also reading rereading the book Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie, Rowley, Catfish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's by Jason Turbo. I got
yeah,
up
he's
to
a friend of mine too. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I got up to it was yeah when after the this was 1972 when the A's eliminated Baltimore and the ALCS and the Blue Moon Odom had started game five, the last game, and then Vita Blue came in. And then they had, he was sort of joke. Vita Blue was sort of joking around with Blue Moon, and then Blue Moon got upset. He was saying, "Why didn't you go nine?" You know, that. And then the quote by the author, "The A's thrived on grinding each other's gears through incessant needling, poking holes in whatever foibles any of them might have displayed on the field or off until business was handled accordingly. Even when things came out correctly, they were sometimes taken wrong. It was part of what made the A's angry and much of what made them good. And now they were World Series bound."
Well, I would say that most teams in baseball, you know, in the locker room, bus trips coming from the airport, they all get on each other, but nobody could do it like the A's. The A's were really, 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 hey, you gotta have some tough skin or sit in the front of the bus.
Now, Reggie got hurt. He couldn't play in the World Series. George Hendrick played center, yeah, in 72. Mm-hmm. This is the first. And then he's also talking about how Reggie Jackson showed up with a mustache in the 72 spring training, and it was the last time an MLB player had facial hair was 1914 with A's catcher Wally Chang. Now, Raleigh Finger or Charlie Finley decided to go along with it and ended up paying the guys to play. And funny thing, in the World Series, the Reds did not allow facial hair. They said, in fact, in 1968, they removed the handlebar mustache from the longtime mascot.
From the guy on their logo. From the guy on their logo. Isn't that something?
Yeah, and going back to, like, 1869, those guys all had mustaches. So, and then there was a funny story here about how they had to keep their hair. They couldn't let them have long hair. And then Pete Rose asked, I guess he didn't like it, he asked Sparky Anderson if Jesus Christ could hit a curveball. And then Anderson said, well, yeah, I think so. And then Rose says, not for the Cincinnati Reds he couldn't, not with that beard.
Yeah.
And then that became, well, they called the, go ahead.
Well, and then, because I had when I first came to big leagues, I had mutton chops and that. But the A's, Charlie pays them $300 each of them. And a couple of them couldn't grow a mustache. But, hey, that's what he did. And facial hair. When I played for the Cubs, no facial hair. The Dodgers, when I went over there, no facial hair. The A's just started that. And that's where I grew a beard. But I had facial hair with the Giants too, but you know, that was back when they wanted everybody to look like they came out of the barbershop, I guess.
Yeah, they called it the 72 series, the hairs versus the squares. And then Dick Green was quoted as saying the A's were really intimidated by the Cincinnati Reds, and Dick Green said, "We just didn't think we could beat them." Raleigh Finger said, we were going to get our asses killed. And, of course, they ended up winning that series. Now, before game one, Jackie Robinson ended up, by chance, met Ken Holtzman, starting pitcher, told him to keep your hopes up and the balls down and the ball down. Mm-hmm. And Holtzman said, I was probably the last major leaguer to talk to Jackie Robinson. He died 9 days later at his home in Stamford, Connecticut, at age 53, of a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Robinson.
Yeah.
He gave a speech, actually talked before the game. So that was...
He spoke about hoping to see his... I think his last line was about seeing a black manager.
Black manager, right. Now, in the series, go ahead.
In third base, because the managers used to coach third base in those days.
Uh-huh.
And then they started having a third base coach, and they went in the dugout, but managed, yeah, back in those days. And Jackie saw he was, could see the future in a lot of things, but he was certainly a civil rights icon, and hey man, he did not only baseball but for America. He made a statement and kind of was instrumental in us desegregating and that kind of thing. I appreciate it, and luckily I got to meet his wife and his daughter before, and just like you, Peter, you know what Jackie Robinson meant to us.
Sure.
And it's a thing that you kind of just like, hey man, I don't know if we got it, as today is kind of confusing, but he certainly did what he could to make us a better nation.
Absolutely, no question about it. God bless Jackie Robinson. In game one, Gene Tennis hit two home runs in his first two at-bats, and he was quoted as saying that, you know, he was transfixed. And he said, it never dawned on me at the time what I was experiencing. No player ever said to me, hey, man, you're in the zone. I didn't even know what a zone was. I'd have thought it was a time zone or something. But then I heard Michael Jordan. Huh?
No, what Gino had, and Reggie spoke of it. Gino had this little box that if if a pitch came in that little box, he's going to get them. And they kept throwing in that little box. And Gino got them. But Gino had a little spot that if you came in there, it was not a good place to be. But Gino was a hell of a player and a great teammate and a leader, tough guy. Him and Vando were roommates. Yeah.
He said he could see everything so clearly, how everybody looked like they were moving in slow motion. So he was in the zone. Do you remember being in the zone where you go up to the plate and you felt like you could do anything?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sometimes that ball comes up there looking like an aspirin. Sometimes it comes up there looking like a basketball blinking on and off saying, hit me hard. Yeah.
Now this really shocked the A's because they thought, Ken Holtzman said, we were looking around and said, oh, you mean they're not supermen? We're supposed to be the underdogs, but we had just had a guy take their best pitcher deep twice. We saw that we could play with these guys.
I don't think coming into that series, I don't think Dick Williams was in awe of Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
and that right there, with him standing over you, you know what? You're going to play some pretty good baseball. And I think that's what happened. We knew how to play the game based on our teaching. I mean, those guys in 72, because I wasn't there, but based on our teaching from Dick Williams, they played the game flawlessly. And that's why whether they were in awe of Cincinnati or not, they were going to play the game correctly. And that's what happened. Yep.
Now, the author talks about how Joe DiMaggio coached Joe Rudy in playing left field. Did he coach the A's when you were there?
No. He was there before me. And Joe, he worked with Rudy, and Rudy still talks me to that and how smart Joe was. And Joe was an icon, but he was also a very, very, he was a consummate baseball player and knew how to play the game and could relay it to the other players. And I remember Joe Rudy talking about Joe DiMaggio and his teachings and his effect on him. Joe DiMaggio, that's the big leagues right there.
Yeah, the author's talking about the dramatic catch Joe Rudy made off the bat of Dennis Menke, and connecting that to DiMaggio's coaching. And then he held the ball aloft to show that he'd caught it. And then the author's saying that he could have doubled up Tony Perez if he had just thrown the ball in right away.
Well, he wanted to make sure that they didn't have him. Because he caught the ball and turned his glove around, and he wanted to show that he had the ball. And because he didn't want them to think it bounced off the wall. I think that's where he was coming from on that, Joe. And whether he got Perez back at first base, I think is a question, but I know that I trust Joe Rudy on doing the right thing, And the first thing you want to do is get the lead runner, and he did that. So,
The A's won the first two games on the road in Cincinnati. Then Charlie Finley gave Joe Rudy a $5,000 bonus for that catch. And then Pete Rose was quoted as saying, Catfish Hunter is a good pitcher, but hell, I'm not going to make him out to be a super pitcher because he's not. He reminds me of Rick Wise. That's about how hard he throws. Or Jim McAndrew. So yeah, I thought, okay, Catfish Hunter is like Rick Wise. How about that? Never heard that before.
Come on, man. Catfish Hunter give you what 300 plus innings a year and 24, 25 complete games and 24, 25 wins. Okay, and comparing him to Rick Wise, you know, Rick Wise was a good pitcher at that time, though. You know, but I would say Rick Wise was more like Catfish Hunter when he had good years than Catfish Hunter being like Rick Wise. And the Hall of Fame will back me up on that.
Now, in game two, the team was flying back to Oakland. Dick Williams took out Mike Epstein for a pinch runner, and both Epstein and Dick Williams were drinking on the plane, and Epstein lost his temper, and he said, I feel you don't appreciate me. This is on the airplane. I've been busting my ass all season, and you take me out of a damn World Series game, and I don't appreciate it. I don't want this to happen again. And then Dick Williams says, I'll do whatever I want. You don't like my kind of baseball. You don't even know what my kind of baseball is. Then the next day, Williams cooled down, and he said, I can't blame a ball player for feeling bad about coming out of the game.
Yeah.
And so he was diplomatic. He didn't want to – he's trying to sort of make up with Mike Epstein after their argument on the drunken argument on the airplane.
Well, I just think that Dick Williams, you know what a good manager does. When a team wins, he gives credit to the ball player. When they lose, he takes the blame. And Dick Williams did that all the time. And as far as when you're on the plane, stuff happens, and that, you know, Dick Williams he's going to do what he thinks is best, and he doesn't have anything to hurt himself by having to beef with a ball player and hurting the team in any way. If Epstein was doing something that Dick Williams wanted him to be in there at that moment, he'd have kept him in there. But when he took him out, he was thinking about winning the game, nothing more, nothing less. Okay.
And then back in game three, they had Johnny Bench a 3-2 count, and Dick Williams went out to the mound, and they did a trick play where they were going to, like an intentional walk, and then they ended up striking out Bench on a – he ended up throwing the ball over the plate. Let's see, who was that?
Yeah.
Oh, it was Raleigh Fingers. He said,
Peter?
Huh?
The bad part about it was it wasn't a fastball. He threw a slider.
Right.
You know, and they were not only trying to trick him, but they didn't want to give him something that he could hit in case it didn't work. Yeah, that was it was a slider when they were doing that. Hey, that's a heck of a pitch. Yeah.
Well, Raleigh Fingers says, what is this, Little League? You don't do this in a World Series game. He had never faced Johnny Bench before. All he could say, all any of them could say was, yes, sir, to Dick Williams.
You know what? Dick had a plan. The worst thing that could have happened was that Bench walked because, I mean, if he missed the pitch, but, you know, hey, if he's going to walk, he's going to walk. But it worked. So you know what? If it was Little League, I'm kind of with Raleigh on there, you don't really need to you put your team out there, and you don't need to trick people. But, hey, man, it worked. So I'm going along with the champion.
Joey from Bucks County, Pennsylvania has a comment, nice comment. Lou from Visalia, California. Let's see. We got a lot of different area codes. The time has flown by.
It always does.
Bill, do you have any final words tonight for our audience?
I thank you guys for tuning in with us, and I enjoy you. Good Lord willing, I'll be back in 2 weeks. And if you think about the North Legacy Project, you can pull it up online.
What a wonderful gift. Go ahead.
And donate, and because we want to make a comment. I mean, help kids flat out. You know, every kid deserves a chance, and that's what we're trying to do. Yeah.
What a wonderful show again tonight with the starting center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's from the early 1970s. Wonderful, Bill, having you on the show again. I enjoy every one. It's just tremendous hearing because you were part of that team. We're over time here. I was at the grocery store the other night. I saw a guy with an Oakland A's cap, and I said, "Hey, cool cap." He goes, "Oh, you like it?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I said, are you from Oakland?" He says, "No, I just like the A's because they won 3 World Series in the 70s. They had mustaches when I was a young guy. I thought it was cool." I said, "You remember Bill North?" He goes, "Oh yeah, played center field, made the last out for Dick Bosman's no hitter." And so anyway, a guy here in Cleveland also remembers the A's. He wears an Oakland A's cap.
Yeah, that's
how about that?
Yeah. You made the last out, and Dick Bosman, no hitter.
Well, that's the thing. He's a Cleveland fan, and so that's what he remembered as a Cleveland fan.
Well, yeah, I remember it too.
Thanks so much, Bill, for coming on the show. It's just a wonderful gift having you on every 2 weeks.
I appreciate it, Peter. It's a gift being able to be there with you, and we have a good time. Nothing more, nothing less. And God bless you and Alice.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, because you're a good man with a good heart. That's why you're my dear wife Alice's favorite podcast guest, and I love talking about the 70s MLB, and you guys, those 3 World Series, tremendous. And all that's why it's great talking to all the guys on that team, keeping those guys alive in memory, all your teammates from the A's, a lot of them are gone now, so you got to talk for them.
Yeah, and I loved them. What a great experience that was to be able to dream that from a little kid and be able to have it happen. And gosh, I've lived one of the most blessed lives anybody could ever live. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Bill North. Next week, we're going to have Matthew DiBiase. We're going to talk in NFL history. Greasy Neal, the coach of the Philadelphia Eagles in the 40s. Marty Schottenheimer, who coached the Browns, Chiefs, Redskins, and Chargers in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And, of course, in 2 weeks, we'll have Mr. Bill North again. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again so much, Mr. Bill North.
Thank you.
Wonderful.